Welcome to another episode of 30 Minutes in the New Testament. This is the post, and I mean post as in directly after Christmas Day episode. We're literally recording this a day after Christmas because we're hardcore like that.
Yeah. Although everyone else in the world has to go back to work today too. So, you know, I guess we're not that hardcore.
Well, we didn't have to do this, but we did.
That's right. It's funny, you know, yesterday, Christmas morning, one of my favorite things to do in the city is go outside on Christmas morning and just look at the difference that takes place. I mean, of course, living in the heart of Manhattan in New York City, what you experience on a daily basis is just constant, like, grind and busy, busy, busy. I mean, it's just it never stops. Everything you see in TV and movies about New York City life, it's true. Except on Christmas Day, when there's almost no cars on the road, there's nobody out, it's so quiet you can hear a whisper. It's really phenomenal. I mean, I stood in the middle of 14th Street, which for those who haven't been to New York, you don't know the importance of that street, but it's a huge, major street in the city. And I stood right in the middle of it and took pictures and had no cars anywhere nearby for minutes.
Yeah.
It's an amazing thing. So, but today you go outside and right back at it, man.
It's
just boom. Yep, everything's moving.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably one of the only days in New York where the vast majority of stuff is closed.
Yes, the vast majority of stuff is closed, and I mean, frankly, in New York, I mean, people leave the city to go home. I mean, most people that live in Manhattan are not from Manhattan, and so they live here for work or school or whatever, and then they go home. Not everybody, but most.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it was a good Christmas. I hope that everyone else had a great Christmas. Don't send me any emails about how Christmas is not a day. It's a season, and we're still in it, and yada, yada, yada. I know. I'm not an idiot. I get it. I'm just referencing the day, commonly known as Christmas Day. All right, saved ourselves those emails. Also,
by the way, happy holidays to you, Dan. So we can get that out of the way.
happy holy days.
That's right.
Yes, indeed. Season's greeting, the season known as Advent and Christmas. You know, there's something I must say, though. By the time when this comes out, there will be only a few days left to get in on the early bird rate for tickets for Here We Still Stand 2018. I'm going to be talking about the Theology of the Cross. October 2018, you want to be there. If you register before the first of the year, you get that early bird rate. There's so much included with your ticket. Get that early price. You just got a couple days from the time this releases to do it. So January 1, the price goes up. So if you want to go, if you went last year, then you already know that you need to jump on that and do it. If you didn't go last year, you got to make it happen. Early bird ticket prices end January 1st. Get on it. HereWeStillStand.org. We want to see you there. All right, Eric, where are we at?
Yes, sir.
In the gospel according to St. Matthew?
Well, we are at Matthew chapter 24, and really we're going to be spending quite a while talking about, talking about the last things, talking about eschatology to some degree or another over, I'm sure, the next few weeks. And so we're sort of entering a section that really, I don't think that you and I have talked a whole lot about the last things or the end times on this podcast. And so I'm actually looking forward to digging into this a little bit.
Well, you know, it's because I don't talk about eschatology that much. It's not unimportant. In fact, if you get eschatology wrong too badly, it really affects a lot of your other doctrines. And actually, I think that we have eschatology pretty jacked up for the most part within what is broadly considered evangelicalism. And part of that has lent itself to an overemphasis of eschatology in our current Christian culture in this country. This is why you see you want to write a book that'll sell copies, write a book about the end of the world.
Mm-hmm.
About all the signs of the times, this kind of stuff. So like, we're addicted to that stuff, and I think that it's unhelpful. I guarantee you, Eric, if you asked your congregation, or just Christians in general, what book would you like me to preach through at least entering in the top three every time.
Revelation. Every time. Yeah, for sure.
People are obsessed with it.
Yeah, and people don't mean like the first few chapters where Jesus is talking to the different churches at the time. They mean get into the nitty-gritty, tell me what these locusts are.
They want to know about they want to know about blood drunk vampire whores riding dragons.
Yes, exactly. It's true. And frankly, I mean, we can interpret those things, but as we mentioned in last week's podcast with Chad, it's so driven by Old Testament thought and Old Testament verses that it takes a long time to do that. It takes a long time to dig into what we're actually being told about the end. I'll just say about my preaching on the end times, what I really try to focus on, because I think you should talk about it. I mean, I think you can't avoid it in Scripture. But I think what you have to do is you have to talk about it from the same sort of voice and perspective that the apostles did when writing about it and when preaching about it, which is to say it is something meant to inspire hope and joy in Christians, not something that was meant to be dissected on prophecy charts at prophecy conferences so that you can try and figure out at least close to the day when Jesus is coming back. That's not the program that the apostles laid out. That's not the program that Jesus lays out here in Matthew 24.
Yeah, and I think that when you talk about eschatology, like, you should talk about Christ.
You can't.
Shocker.
Yeah. to not talk about Jesus and then to quote talk about the end times is a contradiction. It's not possible.
It is, we do it all the time. I tend to think that most people's view of the end of all things is more anti-Christ focused than Christ focused. They do more time. Listen to me. If you're listening to some guy and he's talking to you more about the Antichrist than the actual Christ, just bail. Just bail right there.
Get out of there. Yep. Because the absolute weight of Scripture, when you look at all of Scripture, the mention of the Antichrist, he's there, but he is not central.
No.
Christ is central.
You know what's Antichrist? Talking more about the Antichrist than Christ when you're talking about eschatology.
Yeah. And that's some of the abuses. I mean, we could go on probably this whole podcast talking about misunderstandings and bad interpretations of the end times. But let's just get into the text and let's start dealing with it, which frankly, from the very beginning of this passage might not necessarily be talking specifically about the end times. So let me dig in here. Jesus left the temple and was going away when his disciples came to point out to him the buildings of the temple. But he answered them, "You see all these? Do you not? Truly I say to you, there will not be left here one stone upon another that will not be thrown down." Now let's just stop right there. Obviously, we need to sort of break down what is he referring to here. We know historically what he's referring to. We know that indeed the temple was destroyed in AD 70 by the Roman army. We know that in fact there was that every stone was torn down and thrown down. So this is Jesus prophesying to his disciples that judgment is coming upon the temple. Judgment is coming upon this system of worship. Now, this fits in perfectly fine contextually, because if you remember the chapter before, Jesus is pronouncing his woes to the religious leaders that were so enamored with the temple. Jesus has gone in and cleared out the temple, you know, with whips and overturned tables and the abuses of the temple. So this isn't surprising that he would say this. But this is ultimately one of the things that gets him convicted or tried and convicted before he's on his way to be crucified.
Indeed. I agree.
So
that one seems pretty obvious, right? Not hard. That actually happened. There you go. Yet you do have some people being like, we got to get that temple rebuilt so that temple can be destroyed so Jesus can come back. There's even like weirdos that think that. And let me just tell you, that's not what he's talking. That has already happened.
Yes, that happened. We know it. History records it. No one debates this. This is an event that happened in the first century in the year 70. So that's just, we got to set that as context here. So we move on to verse 3. As he sat on the Mount of Olives, which is why this is referred to often as the Olivet Discourse, the disciples came to him privately saying, "Tell us, when will these things be?" What things? Well, the things he's just mentioned about the temple. When will these things be? And what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? And Jesus answered them, "See that no one leads you astray. For many will come in my name, saying, 'I am the Christ,' and they will lead many astray. And you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not alarmed. For this must take place, but the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines and earthquakes in various places. All these are but the beginning of the birth pains." When
will that start happening?
That's the question. I mean, hasn't this always been happening?
Indeed.
I mean, has there ever been a time in the world's history where there weren't false prophets trying to lead people astray? No. Has there ever been a time where there wasn't wars and rumors of wars? No. Has there ever been a time where nation hasn't risen against nation and the kingdom against kingdom, and where there hasn't been famines and earthquakes in various places? No, and no, and no, and no, and no. So Jesus is basically talking about things that have always gone on, and I think specifically here is saying these things are going to happen before the desecration or before the destruction of the temple. Mm-hmm. I think he's warning them, the disciples, in specific about that time and place. Now, why do I say that about these verses in particular? Well, for one, I mean, thankfully, we have some great Roman historians like Josephus and Tacitus and others that in fact record all of these things happening in that very area. That there are famines, the book of Acts talks about that, that there are famines that are pushing people out. The wars and rumors of wars, there's tens of thousands of people dying all over the world when this happens, right before the destruction of the temple due to wars and rumors of wars. Everything that's mentioned here is stuff that actually is taking place and does take place right before the destruction of the temple.
Yeah, and in a broad sense, continues to take place now. I mean, this is part of the ramifications of the fall. Really, if you want to know what the fall does, like, stuff's broke. It doesn't work. The earth itself is broke. There's earthquakes. It doesn't yield crops the way it's supposed to. It's hard work. I mean, this is part of the deal that Adam has said he's going to have to, like, till the land, and it's going to be stubborn against him. So you have people with starving to death. You have people killing each other. You know, this happens with Cain and Abel right out the gate. I mean, there's just death and war, and that's part of the fall. And so you have this broad sense in which it's like, look, life is tribulation in a fallen mm-hmm. world. It is. And it always mm-hmm. will be until the second coming. The death and resurrection of Christ did not stop that from happening. People are still going to experience this stuff. However, he is also then narrowly speaking of to those people at that time in that place too. So it's mm-hmm. It's both and.
That's right. So, I mean, really what's being done here is, I think what's often done with prophecy, if you read the Old Testament, is you have an immediate fulfillment. I mean, those prophecies do have an immediate fulfillment most of the time. There's a sense in which they're talking about something that's happening at the moment. But we also see in those prophecies something that will happen in the future. And so I think this is very much what's happening here, that Jesus is saying, this is what's going to happen. This is what is going to happen right now, but it will continue on in the future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's even this is what has happened, what is going to happen, and what will happen.
That's right. And so I'm in complete agreement on that. And, you know, just a note here, I love the fact that as he mentions all of these things that are coming, He says, see that you are not alarmed. Now, this is precisely the opposite of what I got whenever I went to prophecy conferences growing up. And I did. I went to a couple of them as a young adult. I was sort of fascinated with this whole, I mean, this is a whole world. I mean, it really is like, it's a big thing, man. And if there's one word that I could use to describe prophecy conferences, it was getting us alarmed. I mean, everybody walks out of those things being Chicken Little, you know, like the sky is falling and they're terrified that it's happening at any moment. And in fact, it's not supposed to be something that terrifies us. Rather, it's supposed to be something that we're not alarmed by, that we recognize is just part of life in the fallen world. It's the beginning of birth pains, which means that we should be looking forward to what comes, which is the birth of a new world, new heaven, new earth.
Hey man, you haven't really dove deep into the abyss of prophetic underground until you've gone to a conference that I went to growing up. And you could tell by the title of this conference that it's legit. And it was called Eaters of the Scroll Conference.
Oh man. I mean that
that is a reference from the Book of Revelation, but it mostly just sounds like a chapter from like the Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, it's not that it's a bad, I mean, the idea of being the eaters of the scroll, like people that really devour the word of God, that's a good thing. But you know what's coming. You know when you walk into that conference, like, you know what you're going to get.
Yeah, yeah.
You're going to get alarmed. You're going to get the exact opposite of what Jesus commands his followers to do. And you're going to get absolute scare tactics.
And you're going to get a t-shirt that says, I eat the scroll.
Does it really say that?
Yeah.
Oh. Oof, this is brutal. All right, we're going to move on because I don't want to talk about that anymore. So verse 9, I still think talking specifically to his disciples in this moment, then they will deliver you up to tribulation and put you to death, and you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake. Did that happen? Read the book of Acts. Read a little church history. That indeed happens.
I wonder, is that verse right there featured in like God's little promise book that you can get at Lifeway?
I don't think so. It's not printed on like Hallmark cards.
Oh, God's little promise book. What we got today? Oh, put to death, delivered up in tribulation, and hated by all nations. All right, sweet.
Yeah, speaking of the theology of the cross, right? And then many will fall away and betray one another and hate one another. Again, something we see happening in the pages of the New Testament. People like Demas and Alexander and other people that were once confessing to be Christians that indeed do this exact thing. And many false prophets will arise and lead many astray. Again, we know that this happened in the early church. Early church fathers record a number of false prophets. Early historians, Josephus mentions a guy, named Theudas, or Theudas, who has this massive following of people. That he takes out to the Jordan around the time of the destruction of the temple. Verse 12, and because lawlessness will be increased, the love of many will grow cold, but the one who endures to the end will be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom will be proclaimed throughout the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come. So, now we're getting some, again, we're getting this both and already and not yet sort of thing. On the one hand, you could fairly read verse 14, I think, to be talking about the end of the temple. When he says the end will come, it doesn't necessarily mean the end of the world. But it can. It could. We do know, I mean, when people, sometimes the objections that are brought up, is it says, well, this gospel of the kingdom will be proclaimed throughout the whole world as a testimony to all nations, but that hasn't happened yet. To which the response would be, you know, the Apostle Paul, actually, in his writings, talks about the gospel being proclaimed to the whole world at that time. But what does he mean? Well, I think what he means is the whole known world to them at the time. Now, I think both readings, both understandings are totally fair. I think they're totally biblical, and I think they're hermeneutically valid. But either way, whatever your view on this, whether it's talking about the future, whether it's talking about the end of the temple in the first century, I think both have their valid points.
Agreed. I think that like one thing that gets missed in this is also that you have all this stuff where it sounds like, man, this sounds pretty terrible. Sounds pretty awful, man. Like, I mean, people are falling away and there's false prophets and the lawlessness is going to abound and people's love is growing cold and you got to endure. But there's this, though. This sounds pretty good. And this gospel of the kingdom will be proclaimed throughout the whole world as a testimony to all nations. And then the end will come. Like, in other words, there's going to be like a whole lot of junk going on, but that's not going to stop it.
Right.
This is the gates of hell shall not prevail against the message of the church, right?
That's right.
And so there is this is all true, and yet he also has this positive thing at the end where he's like, look, all this is going to happen, but the message will go to the ends of the earth, and the end and the end will come, and the end will come is a positive thing.
Mm-hmm. That's right. The end will come is this is one of the things you just have to have drummed into your head over and over and over again. The end is supposed to give us hope. It's supposed to inspire us, especially in those days where things are just like, I mean, things are brutal, you know, and you're going, man, I can't wait for this world with all of its fallenness and all of its brokenness to finally be done. And to finally be in the kingdom that will have no end, where there'll be no more tears and no more suffering and no more pain. So it's meant to cause us to look forward to what's coming, not cause us to be alarmed or filled with dread.
Right, yeah. I mean, the end is a positive because it's the last end.
Mm-hmm.
There are no more ends after that. Like, I mean, the end is the beginning of that which has no end.
That's right.
Which is pretty great.
Yeah. I like that. Pretty great.
It's pretty great.
Pretty great.
Yeah. So.
So he continues on in verse 15. Now this is an interesting phrase. So when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by the prophet Daniel standing in the holy place, let the reader understand, that's in parentheses, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let the one who is on the housetop not go down to take what is in his house. And let the one who is in the field not turn back to take his cloak. And alas, for women who are pregnant and for those who are nursing infants in those days, pray that your flight may not be in winter or on a Sabbath. For then there will be great tribulation, such as has not been from the beginning of the world until now, no, and never will be. And if those days had not been cut short, no human being would be saved, but for the sake of the elect, those days will be cut short. Now, again, I think there's two ways of reading this. And the reason there's a few different ways of reading this is because it's not an easy passage to interpret. On the one hand, if you believe that this is primarily speaking about the future, like the last days, this passage right here, then it's tough because you have him talking about the abomination of desolation standing in the holy place. Where is that place? It's the temple.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there is no temple today. The temple is destroyed.
Another reason why people want to rebuild that temple so they can have an abomination stand in it.
It's true. I mean, so those who would read this as being about the future, which is, again, it can be, I think, a valid reading. I don't think that this is, like, unorthodox at all. As a matter of fact, it's probably a majority view. Then you'd have to, by necessity, say, okay, this is at some point the temple will be rebuilt, and then this will happen. Could be. However, there is another understanding that relates, again, back to the first century, which is to say, the abomination of desolation, which is essentially just setting up an idol in the holy place of the temple, could actually refer to, it could refer to Caligula setting up, wanting to set up his statue in the temple, which was the height of offense and idolatry. All the things that are described that happen after the abomination of desolation, it could be just the army of Rome coming into the temple and standing in the holy place. But all the things that happen here that are described in these verses we just read are things that we know indeed did happen when the temple was destroyed. People fled Judea. People ran to the hills. People did everything they could to escape. That it was very, very, very difficult days. And so that's why he says, pray that your flight may not be in winter or on a Sabbath. Mm-hmm. So again, if you take this as he's speaking directly to the people, his disciples that he knows are going to be in Judea, that he knows are going to be in Jerusalem, then there is a way of understanding that this is specifically about first century stuff at this point.
Right. I agree. Again, I agree. Maybe this is helpful. Neither me nor Eric think that the temple needs to be rebuilt in order for anything to happen. I have a view that says that lots of things could happen, but nothing is necessary for the return of Christ. He can come back at any time.
That's right.
There's nothing that needs to happen.
Yeah, and where do we get that from? Well, we get that from him. That's the way he sort of describes it, that he's going to come like a thief in the night, that we are not going to know the time, the day, or the hour. So there's going to be a sense in which there is going to be surprise for everybody when this happens. And if you could just like logically sort of plot events that take place in order to figure out his coming, then none of those statements really make sense.
Yeah, and that kind of happens what he says here next. We'll probably kind of end with this. But when he says, then if anyone says to you, look, here is the Christ, or there he is, do not believe it. For false Christ and false prophets will arise and perform great signs and wonders, so as to lead away, if possible, even the elect. See, I have told you beforehand. So if they say to you, look, here he is in the wilderness, do not go out. If they say, look, there he is in the inner rooms, do not believe it. For as the lightning comes from the east and shines as far as the west, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. Wherever the corpse is, there the vultures will gather. I mean, okay, like we see this, and this has been the case forever. I mean, since Christ has been, people have been falsely predicting his return. We've seen people claim to be Christ. We've seen, it seems like every year somebody has set a date. I mean, there's entire cults built on setting up false Christ or setting up second comings. And so like that only day I'm like pretty sure Christ isn't coming back is like a day that somebody says he definitely is. it's just insanity. And so as he's telling you, like, look, don't listen to anyone who tells mm-hmm. you they know.
Mm-hmm.
Just automatically dismiss that person. Like, do not do it. And what he says is that, because it's going to be like this, it's going to be like lightning that appears in one part of the sky, but you see from everywhere, like you're going to know when he comes back. He's not coming back in secret. You're going to be like, oh, he came back. Did you not hear? He's over out in the wilderness. Wrong. Like there will be no doubt. You will know that he's returned. And then it has this weird, crazy line at the end where he says, where the corpse is, there the vultures will gather.
When you think about vultures, they fly above the corpse for a long time, and they can be seen from long away. Mm-hmm. So it fits within his general idea here that, like, you're going to know. Mm-hmm. You will absolutely know when I come. It's not going to be hidden. It's not going to be in the wilderness somewhere. It's going to be universal, worldwide. Everybody will be able to look up and see, I'm coming again to redeem all things, to renew all things, to restore all things, to make things right.
Right. So it is basically like this, guys. It's been crappy. It's going to still be crappy. But the end is a good thing. It's a good thing.
I'm going to tweet that out.
And it is promised to us that in the midst of this thing called the tribulation that we know as life, God has not abandoned us, and he has continued to lavish upon us in this state of tribulation still all his good and gracious gifts. He gives us many, many things that make life, while difficult, he has given us many things that make even life in a fallen world, even life as a sinner, still good.
That's right.
And so I don't subscribe to views of life that are too fatalistic. I think that life is ultimately a gift and life is ultimately a good thing, even as broken and terrible as we sometimes are. I still think that life itself is a good thing. And that what we have is a promise of it, of not just it's going to be good because it's terrible now. I think it is good now and it's going to be perfect.
That's right. And here's what I just say. I mean, when it comes to all this, folks, put away the prophecy charts, throw them away. They're not going to do any good. These things are always going to be going on until the final day. But at the same time, look up, because your redemption draws near.
Amen. That is it. We're out of time. Eric, thanks for hanging out with us. Guys, get on over to HereWeStillStand.org. Get that ticket. Get that early bird special. We want to hang out with you in sunny San Diego. I mean, you guys are probably all freezing to death right now. Just think about that sun and that water. It's going to be so good. Get that ticket. All right. We will talk to you later. Bye-bye.